It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The United States and Iran have agreed to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and stop the months-long Iran war while negotiations continue. That conflict has boosted inflation and energy prices in Wisconsin and around the country. The timeline on a full reopening of the key CP passage is still uncertain. It's not clear how long it could take for the economic impact to reach us in Wisconsin. Will Wisconsinites feel much relief from rising prices if this agreement holds? Thomas Kemp is with us, chair and professor in the Department of Economics at UW-Eau Claire. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right. Knowing that in the world of diplomacy, there are a lot of maybes and ifs and uncertainties. That said, if the strait here where all this oil and fertilizer hasn't been passing through over the last few months, if it does reopen, what do you see in terms of the time it would take for that to start percolating and affecting the global economy?
Well, it's going to start affecting it almost immediately. The question is really how much, right? And so probably see some reduction in increases in prices, right? So prices probably won't keep rising as fast as they've been rising for the last few months. But I think it's unlikely that you're going to see a return to where prices were prior to this problem, because there's still a lot of uncertainty around this, and then also a lot of folks who have started rerouting supply chains. Excuse me, they're gonna stay away from this uncertainty if they can do so at all.
Oil and prices were falling sharply after this deal was announced, but a lot of countries were rationing things like oil, natural gas, gasoline. The United States not in that position. We just saw higher prices. How long does it take for supply shock to end and prices, especially for those fuels, to start coming down?
Well, different types of fuels will come down at different rates. Some of them that are more competitive markets, retail gasoline, for example, hazardous to speculate on that, but I would expect they would come down more quickly than some other rates. Some of these the larger purchases of these things, natural gas and so on and so forth, even fertilizers, those are on longer term contracts, so there may have been some escalators written into those. It'll take some time for them to pass through. The short but unsatisfactory answer is that it's probably going to take a little bit of time.
You mentioned fertilizer. That's key to a key industry here in Wisconsin, agriculture. And it sounds like, again, in these early announcements, there's more focus on getting oil and gas through that strait than the fertilizer products. Is this something that, hey, maybe 2026, we've got what we've got, and we'll see 2027, the impact of fertilizer starting to flow? A lot of it comes from that part of the world.
Yeah, well, I'll have to admit that I probably don't know enough about farming to know the answer to that question. I would expect that given that it's mid-June, that a lot of the demand for fertilizer has come and gone in the state, but perhaps that's not so. I expect that there will be some additional fertilizer on the market and available for farmers who could utilize it still this year. You're talking probably a month or two before that fertilizer, if it's still in the Persian Gulf, to get to a place like Wisconsin. But so that would be, late August or thereabouts. So maybe it still happens in 2026, but yeah, probably 2027.
All right, looking bigger picture now, I'm looking at a chart of inflation in the United States over the last 100 years or so. Yes, it's peaking now over this last few months. It hasn't hit the levels it did in, say, 2022, plus or minus, with the COVID shock, nor near what we saw in the 1970s and 80s. When we think about this long-term economics-wise, yeah, we feel it in the moment. Is this a blip on the radar that isn't going to really have a lot of lasting impact on the American economy?
Yeah, I would say that's accurate. 10 years from now, it's probably not going to make all that much difference on the U.S. economy. There are more significant issues impacting the U.S. economy that we're making ourselves that we'll feel the effects more by then than this event.
All right, I can't leave that hanging. What other significant issues that we're making ourselves would have a bigger long-term impact?
Well, For many years now, the United States has been really quite flush with capital. It's the capital markets. There's a lot of capital kicking around the United States, and we're directing that capital in a variety of directions. That is to say, we are investing in new technologies, new ways of organizing business, new supply chains, so on and so forth. And the real question is whether those are solid investments or those are malinvestments or poor investments.
Sounds like you're talking about AI and data centers and things like that as a big subject of those investments.
Well, maybe that's certainly one of the big items in there. We're certainly gambling a lot on relatively little. If it turns out that those AI and data centers make American workers significantly more productive, then we'll feel those effects in terms of a improved American economy and improved American wealth. But if they don't, right, if they don't yield those productivity gains, then we'll be feeling the opposite effects. And those are likely to be much larger, longer term than the Straits of Hormuz will be for the U.S. For regional players, this is a total change of the game, to use that hackneyed phrase. If you're the UAE, if you're Qatar, if you're heck, if you're even Iran, this is a big deal. This is a big deal. But the US, less of a deal.
We're talking about what a deal to end the Iran war could mean for consumers and businesses in Wisconsin. Thomas Kemp is with us, chair and professor in the Department of Economics at UW-Eau Claire. When we see jumps in inflation, the cost of key products like gas prices, food prices, and things like that, Thomas, what do we know about what consumers do? What kind of areas do we cut back in that might affect the wider economy?
Yeah, it's kind of, when I teach. Well, let's talk about trade deficits, because that's, in some theory, how we got into this situation. I teach my first year students about trade deficits. The surest way to get out of a trade deficit is just wreck the economy, because then you can't afford to buy imported goods. And the data backs that pretty solidly. As these prices rise, consumers do shift away from goods and services that are marginally less necessary. You think of the things that any of your listeners, right? So what do you stop buying? And it's probably not things like healthcare. It's probably not things like education. If you needed legal services, it's probably not that. What it is it might be some smaller ticket consumer goods, might be vacations, things like that. Those items all have relatively low domestic value added. Compared to the former list of items, which have relatively high domestic value added, that is the former list, legal services, medical, healthcare, these all contribute very significantly to the U.S. economy, where sort of smaller ticket consumer items contribute marginally less to the U.S. economy. If you allow me, I need to explain that a little bit further, and that's that. We might think like, well, I spend a lot of money on small ticket consumer items, but yeah, a lot of the value out of that is domestic though. So if you think about most of the markup on a lot of the seemingly imported consumer items that one buys at the store, a lot of that markup is at the retail or the wholesale level, which is inside the United States. What you see is a movement away from relatively smaller tickets consumer items and larger ticket luxury items or sort of luxury expenditures, and then towards sort of more domestic produced mainstay items with inelastic demand, as we say in economics, or basically items that you can't do without.
When I've talked to you and other economists over the last year plus or so about the job market, it seems like the trend here is, okay, companies aren't massively laying people off, but they're also not particularly hiring people. And uncertainty is a big part of this. We don't want to make big moves and we don't know what the future holds. This Iran war, did that contribute to that uncertainty and reinforce that big question mark in the minds of people who hire or don't hire people?
Yeah, uncertainty is definitely the word of the era that we live in. Certainly nothing new to the US economy or even the global economy, but does not seem to be Well, let's just say that things seem very uncertain on almost all fronts. And as I always say, right, uncertainty is expensive. So if you're trying to operate as a business, right, you are hedging against uncertainty. If you're a consumer, you're hedging against uncertainty. Everybody is sort of holding back a little bit because of uncertainty and maybe a lot bit. The labor market in particular, right? So the jobs reports the last couple months have either been revised upward or were larger than expected. So there does seem to be some hiring going on recently. Certainly prior to that, there was a lot of evidence that firms were sort of holding off on hiring. So perhaps we're past that time. It's really hard to say more locally here in Wisconsin. I don't see really a huge boon in job growth. So it's somewhat hard for me to reconcile those more local anecdotal observations that I see with the larger federal numbers. That's not to say that I dispute them. I certainly do not. But it may be that the region here is maybe lagging behind the rest of the United States a little bit, which it often does.
A twist here, Thomas. Last time I talked to you, it was about the economics of skateboarding and the value of recreation, right, and entertainment on the economy. We've got this World Cup going on now, not happening in Wisconsin at all, of course. Does it hosting an event like the World Cup bring an economic boost?
Well, yes, certainly to the region, right? So to hosting location, the World Cup is going to bring some. Here, I thought I was getting all excited to talk about
Sorry.
skateboarding here. That's the World Cup, right? I know nothing about soccer or football, as the rest of the world calls it. But yeah, for sure, it's going to bring some local economic impact. But it's relatively short-lived. The real benefit of those type of events like the World Cup are sort of the prestige and sort of soft value that it brings to a nation. For example, the whole world is still able to participate in this thing, this World Cup, here in the United States, despite all this other stuff going on, with the uncertainties that we've alluded.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Thomas Kemp, Chair and Professor in the Department of Economics at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the impact of the end of the Iran war, apparent end, on Wisconsin's economy. Coming up, join a robotic dive into the depths of Lake Superior, find out about the underwater world of Superior Maximus, the deepest point in the Great Lakes.
We're going down in darkness for a pretty long time, so it's kind of magical when we get close to the bottom and we can flip those lights on, and it's like a whole other world.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Researchers are using a robot to venture into the deepest part of the world's largest freshwater lake, traveling 1,300 feet below the surface of Lake Superior. It's an area known as Superior Maximus. The robot descends more than 3.5 football fields, including the end zones, to where no light can penetrate and only a handful of species can survive. The expedition team hopes to learn about a recent phenomenon of emaciated lake trout so thin that scientists refer to them as zombie fish. They also hope the images help people gain a greater appreciation for the Great Lakes. Filmmaker Yvonne Drabert helped guide the expedition. She's co-founder of Inspired Planet Productions, a fellow at the Royal Canadian Geographical Society and a National Geographic Explorer. She spoke with Kate Archer-Kent.
Give us a sense of this environment that's 1,300 feet below the surface. What is it like down there?
Well, no one's been there for 40 years, so we didn't know what we were going to find. But once you get down there, the pressure down there is about 40 times what we experience up on the surface. So there's going to be some weird life that lives down there that's super specialized living down there. It's actually kind of more like the surface of the moon than what we see up here on the top of the water. So we were pretty excited about what we might find, and we did find some pretty cool critters down there.
Pretty cool critters. I mean, the light from your robot shining on this environment, be our eyes and ears. What do you see and hear from the images that are down there?
Yeah, well, it's 1,300 feet down, so we lose the light, 100 meters, 80 meters from the surface. So we're going down in darkness for a pretty long time. So it's kind of magical when we get close to the bottom and we can flip those lights on, and it's like a whole other world. And so when we get down, we flip the lights on and we see lots of these little critters called mysis. They're like a freshwater shrimp. And folks probably haven't seen these guys around because they are a deep water species. But every day they actually move up and down as the sun sets. They come higher up in the water column, and then when the sun rises again, they come back down to the bottom. So we find them down there in the darkness, and we see them zooming all around. And the other critter that we find down there, quite a few of these guys, we found a lot of deep water sculpin. And so that's a fish that spends its entire life on the lake bottom. It doesn't have a swim bladder, so it always just sits down there on the bottom. And, you know, these guys are pretty special. They can handle all that pressure, and they eat a lot of these mysis shrimp that we see zooming around. So it's a pretty active, life-filled environment down there.
How do they interact or react to your equipment suddenly coming down into their world? Do they scatter away from the light?
It's interesting. These are dark environment creatures. So we suspect there might be some impact from the lights, but we actually think the sculpin might also be using the lights to help them hunt for mysis. And so we have seen a bit of that activity. And we actually have lasers on our robot that we use to measure things underwater. And we found with a few different fish, including the deep water sculpin, that the sculpin will chase the lasers, kind of like, you know, cats with laser pointers up here. So they are, you know, it doesn't seem to be too detrimental to them. And they do seem to use it to their advantage, which is pretty cool.
You mentioned that there was this expedition to Superior Maximus in 1985. What was that expedition like compared to now? And what is known about this area?
Yeah. So in the late 80s, we had submersible expeditions going around the Great Lakes using a big sub, the Johnson Sea Link 2, to go and see what was at the bottom of our lakes. And that happened, you know, 1985, 1986, they visited this part of the world. They even put down a time capsule down there that we were hoping to see, but haven't found it yet. But, you know, we had this period after that where no one's been down there since. And those were big expeditions. It was a giant research vessel, a lot of funds going into it. But, you know, technology has really moved forward. And 40 years later, a small crew like us, along with the help of the DNR, who, you know, is there as a great support for us, we're able to go out there and just check it out ourselves with a much smaller crew and a much smaller robot. So instead of putting humans in a sub and sending them down, we're able to send the robot down and see, you know, 4K video in real time of what we're looking at. So, you know, things have changed a bit, but I think that same spirit of exploration runs through all of these missions.
You are making this film, Hidden Below the Great Lakes. It's called, set to debut in 2028. What do we have to gain by going to this depth? What do we learn?
Ooh. Well, you know, I think we've all seen these really amazing films and videos from life in the ocean, right? Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of time seeing sharks and whales and coral reefs, but we live right here on the Great Lakes. And so there's a pretty amazing universe of life and ecosystems just right outside our doors. And so for us, it's really about showing people what's down there, what's right in their own backyard, so that maybe when they close their eyes and think of, you know, life in the water, they think of freshwater species, because that's what's right next door to us. And if they think about them, they can see them through things like our robot videos, they might care a little more about the future of those animals. So that's kind of our goal. And if we can show people, you know, what's down there, and if we can see that these are active living environments, we may all try to conserve those environments a little better for the future.
Yvonne, you've said how diving to these depths, it's not like a one and done adventure. You need to go again and again, and sometimes you won't find what you're looking for from what the robot gives you, but you keep going, you keep trying. What does success look like for you in these dives?
Yeah, our live stream to Superior Maximus really was just the start for us. With wildlife videography, you're not generally just going out there and getting the really magical stuff right away. You're going and you're learning about the environment, you're learning when animals are active, and it takes quite a bit of time. With our adventure to Superior Maximus there, we went to the deepest spot because, you know, obviously, that's what we told people we were going to do. But we often look for places underwater that have cool bathymetry, so contours on the landscape, rock piles, cliffs, edges under there, because that's where fish like to hang out. So we did have a really good look at Superior Maximus. We even went back again to have another look after the live stream. But we're also exploring all that deep water environment all around Superior Maximus to see who's living down there and to try to get some shots of these other animals that we didn't see during the live stream.
It also, that having that footage must really not only help scientists, but help us, you know, have a new appreciation for the Great Lakes and this system and what we can't see.
Yeah, we really like to show folks, you know, the unexpected, something they might not have seen before or know about, and just try to expand their imaginations about what life looks like in our lakes. It's really satisfying for us to be able to work with someone like Sean Sitar and his crew from the DNR to share that footage to see if there's any value in it scientifically. For instance, we saw a whole lot of deep water sculpin, and that was a little surprising for Sean how many we saw. So maybe there's some value there, but really we're trying to connect with all of the folks who live around the lakes. There's 40 million of us living around the lakes to try to make a deeper personal connection to what's out there.
Yvonne, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this expedition.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
That is Canadian filmmaker Yvonne Drabert, who helped guide the expedition to the deepest point of Lake Superior. Now we turn to Sean Sitar, a science officer with the research vessel Lake Char and a fisheries research biologist with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, who was part of this expedition. Sean, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You've studied the Great Lakes and the Superior Maximus for decades now, and this is the first time you've seen this depth of Lake Superior really up close. What was that experience like for you?
It was really exciting. As you've mentioned, I've studied this for quite some time, for 20 years, and it's really exciting to have eyes on the environment I've been studying indirectly. I think one of the great challenges in fisheries compared to other wildlife biology is how the animal lives in its environment. We normally can't see that, especially in this deep water work. So it was really exciting to get eyes on the bottom.
As those images start to come back up to you in the boat, what are you seeing and what are you kind of digesting as these images come in?
So obviously we're looking for life, but also that's an important thing for the animals, the habitat. So at Superior Maximus, one of the, I guess, surprising things I noticed was the presence of rocks. I think for most people, that may seem somewhat mundane or, you know, there's no context for that. But typically in large lakes and deep water areas, even in the oceans, a lot of the deeper zones are muddy or silty. But we saw quite a bit of rock and lake trout and other species of fish rely on rocks to deposit their eggs in. So it's spawning habitat. So to me, that was really exciting to see.
How can you tell if a habitat is healthy at that depth, especially when you haven't seen it from day to day, year to year, decade to decade?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So at least for fish spawning habitat, for something like the lake trout, which is related to the salmon, they actually need pretty clean, small boulder-sized rocks. And the interstitial spaces, the spaces in between them, when the eggs fall into that, it creates a protective environment so that predators can't get to them and also wave and current activities can't dislodge them. So the habitat and the rocks down there look pretty clean. You know, it's normal to have a little bit of plankton on top of that or silt. But in degraded environments such as, you know, where zebra mussels, an invasive mussel that invaded the Great Lakes in Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, they've encrusted everything. They've removed a lot of that interstitial space. So Fortunately, what we saw down there looked very healthy.
As part of this mission, you and your team are also on the lookout for zombie fish, these emaciated lake trout that have been increasing in numbers. What can you tell us about this aspect and why you're studying this fish?
So I think most people don't realize under the radar, there are a lot of scientists studying the health of the Great Lakes ecosystem. So the Michigan has a presence on all four of the Great Lakes with a fleet of research vessels. So we happen to be the Lake Superior one, and we study fish populations, both near shore and also offshore. So we've been studying the siskoids since out there at Superior Maximus since 2006, and they are the deep water form of the lake trout. So there's actually four subspecies of lake trout in Lake Superior. We're fortunate to have that, that type of diversity. And the siskoid is the deep water form that has high adaptations to deal with low light conditions and also deep water. And since over the last 20 years, we've noticed a slight decline in the populations, which is normal in ecology. You know, we have these predator prey cycles that operate. However, over the last 3 years, we noticed a higher incidence of emaciated fish. Typically in surveys, we look for anomalies in fish. So we do see emaciated fish once in a while. And, you know, there's a very small fraction of populations where some animals just have some health issues or they don't compete as well for food. So we see that to some low incidence. But however, the last 3 years, we saw a high incidence in the deeper parts of Lake Superior, which are in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so the levels were so high that we realized that something significant is operating down there.
I was shocked about the light from the robot shining right on a Busch beer can. You know, like that to me is so surprising. How can our pollution reach this remote place on the planet?
Well, there's like two dimensions to it. One, that probably is an older beer can. So, you know, we are learning to take our environment more. Mm-hmm. But the persistence of human impact is longer than we think. So it's a good example of that. And hopefully, you know, once people kind of laugh about it, they can reflect on like, well, you know, we do have an impact on this planet. And we are the species that has the responsibility to take care of it, too.
With Superior Maximus, you call deep water areas fragile in a place where there is no room for air. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
So life on Earth in extreme environments are very delicate. So if you look at the Arctic or like Superior Maximus or high alpine areas, it's a very harsh environment. And just like some humans that live in harsh environments, they have to have the right set of skills and traits to live in that environment. You know, when we live in cities or more temperate areas, you know, we have that luxury of a lot of redundancy, but these other areas are very extreme. So you can't, you know, make a mistake, so to speak. So when we think about Superior Maximus, another way to look at the Great Lakes is think of the high peaks of the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. So Lake Superior is like Mount Everest. And so this area around Superior Maximus is like the summit. So, you know, it's very difficult for life to live there, but it does. And it ends up being very fragile. So when we look at extreme environments and animals and these ecosystems that are extreme, they can be a barometer or like a canary in a coal mine of indicating effects from humans. You know, they can give us a good gauge of impact. So if they're very healthy, like we see Superior Maximus is pretty healthy, that's a good sign about the ecosystem.
But what might it say about these emaciated fish? Are you having to look in other places or try a different hypothesis as to what might be going on?
I'm not the only researcher on the Great Lakes. Actually, we have a great community of really smart people working in all jurisdictions, the tribes, the federal government, our Canadian counterparts, and universities. So at least in Lake Superior, I've spoken with my colleagues, and none of them have really seen many emaciated or zombies. So fortunately, this is really localized in the deepest extent. So again, you know, this is an extreme environment, and maybe that region has a food limitation. But we are also checking for other things like disease and also contaminants to make sure.
Before we let you go, what does the weather and the conditions need to be like on Lake Superior in order to put that equipment down to such a depth to allow that robot to go down?
That's a really great question. So working in the Great Lakes is unusual in that a lot of freshwater scientists are trained inland, working in lakes and rivers. And so we have this concept, you know, in relation to land. And then we have our counterparts in the marine fisheries that work in, you know, way offshore in giant systems. But the few of us that work on the Great Lakes, we're kind of caught in between. So it's kind of a hybrid of all that. And yeah, so the Great Lakes are like mini oceans and they have great logistical challenges. So the weather has to be really good for us to conduct many of our operations because it becomes unsafe if sea conditions are too bad. And especially for the work we saw with the ROV, with Inspired Planet Group, you have to have really good conditions because that vehicle going down there is tethered. So you can't have a lot of wave action that torques on that. When we deploy nets at Superior Maximus, it is the maximum extent of where nets can be deployed on the bottom. And that 1,300 foot of water creates great resistance. So imagine a clothesline full of clothes that you're dragging through water. So if you're along the beach, it's not a big deal, but we're talking about a net full of fish from the bottom. And it takes us 2 hours just to get the net from the bottom to the surface at Superior Maximus. Typically, when we do fish surveys near shore, it's a 15 to 20 minute operation.
Wow. Wow. Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Sean Sitar, a science officer with the research vessel Lake Char and a fisheries research biologist with the Michigan DNR. Earlier, we heard from Canadian filmmaker and National Geographic explorer Yvonne Drabert. They talked to host Kate Archer-Kent. The film project is titled Hidden Below the Great Lakes. You can find their work on the Great Lakes, including around the Door County Peninsula, at inspiredplanet.ca. Coming up, a longtime Wisconsin soccer player and coach lost his hands and feet after a near-fatal illness. He shares his story in a new memoir.
I didn't want to face it, but yet I did. Because to me, the first thing that crossed my mind after hearing about the amputations was I'm done playing.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Scott Martin was a rising star in Wisconsin's soccer community, first as a player, then as a college coach. But he was struck by a rare flesh-eating infection that put him in a coma. He spent weeks fighting for his life. Ultimately, doctors had to amputate his hands and parts of both feet to save him. In the months and years that followed, Martin had to rebuild his body, his mind, and his identity as a coach and athlete. And he had to adapt to living with a disability, from facing discrimination to learning to use special electrically controlled hands. He chronicles his story in his new book, Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. Martin lives in Stevens Point, where he continues to coach soccer. His memoir is out now. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. Very good to be here.
Well, I want to take your soccer career up to the point where the action in your book starts. Tell us a little bit about your background in soccer that led you to being a coach at UW-Eau Claire.
I had gone up the traditional ranks of first getting into education, and I was teaching social studies and history at West Bend. Had earned some accolades throughout my career coaching at the high school level. Marilyn Scrivseth, who was the athletic director at the UW-Eau Claire at the time, got a hold of me. We had a great meeting and asked me to come on board and start the program. So that was really an interesting time to be able to take something from nothing and build it. So our first year, we ended up being nationally ranked, and everything was going on good from there until we got to a little bit of a fork in the road.
Yeah. And again, before that fork in the road, you had also played at UW-Oshkosh. And this is before, right, soccer was the thing that kids did. You were on an earlier cutting edge for U.S. soccer in a lot of ways.
Yeah, actually, when I was 16, I was playing for the men's team, and we would be playing against larger clubs in the Midwest at that time. So there's a lot of firsthand learning by getting your butt kicked. So actually, at that time, Rob, a lot of it was educating the public, educating the kids that were growing up. A lot of people. One of my favorite things was trying to explain the offside rule to parents at the time in the mid 70s. So that was a difficult thing, but we knew what we had to do to make this game move forward in the United States.
You mentioned that fork in the road that really changed a lot of, I think, your vision for your future. Talk us through what happened.
That summer after my first year at UW Eau Claire, like I said, we were nationally ranked. I was heading over to Europe with a group of college players playing three top tournaments over there. I always had opportunities to go in as a guest player. The year before that, I played against the Dutch Olympic team because I knew the coach. So everything was looking great. Nike got a hold of me and said, we've heard some good things. Hey, why don't you come on down and speak at our Midwest camp? 100 of the top high school players in the country. Yeah, you bet. You know, we're going to be their national players, coaches from across the country. And when I got there, I was feeling okay. But after the first day, we got into a coaches exhibition match. And I actually, Rob, I've never done this before. I had to pull myself out because of fatigue. I had no idea what was going on. But I spent that night either throwing up profusely or sweating like crazy and shivering like crazy in my dorm room, realizing something was wrong. Didn't know where any doctors were outside of Chicago, but my mom was in Janesville, an hour and a half away. So we all know if doctor's not available, you go to mom. She, of course, in her female wisdom, said something's wrong. Get your butt over to the emergency room right away. And that's where things started tumbling in the wrong direction and going back to speaking about that fork in the road.
And ultimately, you end up in a coma. What you wake up and you do not know what has been happening for what, weeks, a month, I think, at this point.
A month.
Yeah.
Yeah, a month. I woke up for a doctor. I think he was dancing around the issue and he was soft about it, but I couldn't move because I had lost 40 pounds of muscle through atrophy, being in a coma for a month. That sort of thing happens. And I couldn't speak because I was intubated. There were numerous machines in the room. And then he started going into the spiel about what happened. He said, okay, you had contracted group A strep with necrotizing fasciitis. Okay, I kind of get that. But then when he dropped the bomb of saying the media has been calling it the flesh-eating disease, you know, this was what killed Jim Henson in 1990, creator of the Muppets. Then he mentioned the word amputation. Okay. And that's when I think my brain started shutting down, Rob, to be in all honesty. That's what I did. I skipped past denial, or excuse me, I didn't skip past denial. I held on to denial strong and hard for years to come. I didn't want to face what was going on. All of a sudden, going from a white guy in athletics being successful to all of a sudden now being labeled as disabled. And I started labeling myself as disabled as well.
You find out you've lost your hands. You're never going to be able to walk again like you did. You went through a long process of rehabilitation. In some ways, one blessing, one benefit of your athletic career, and your doctors and rehab people said to us, you had a mindset that let you get through that rehab process. Tell us a little bit about that.
I had the work set to be able to go into it, but yet I had no clue what was going on. There were 4 months of rehabilitation in a hospital setting that I still had yet to go through. And then it was, now what? And now what? No clue of what was going to happen. Prosthetists that I worked with, you know, on creating items for disabled people with amputations, had never worked with a person that was bilateral hand amputee, let alone bilateral partial foot amputee. So I became a quad amputee. How am I going to deal with that? How am I going to deal with that in our society that doesn't fare well with the disabled community as it is?
And this, I think, for a lot of people is a version of a nightmare. Take the thing you love the most in the world, in your case, soccer, and take away your perception of your ability to do it. You do come back and coach soccer, and we'll get into that. But in that moment, and in those weeks, knowing that, hey, you were never going to be able to go out on a soccer field and play like you had before, how did your mind work with that?
I didn't want to face it, mm-hmm. but yet I did. because to me, the first thing that crossed my mind after hearing about the amputations was I'm done playing. I was still playing at a higher level. We had just won an indoor championship. I was playing out of Minneapolis. And that was really hard. The way I try to describe it to people is this. Think of a concert pianist, not saying I was an amazing player or anything, but to me, concert piano, and all of a sudden somebody takes it away. There it goes. You know, my heart, my art was gone now. That's what I found. Very difficult.
We're talking to Scott Martin of Stevens Point. He's the author of the new memoir, Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. It follows his experience as a soccer player and coach, the illness that led to the loss of both of his hands and parts of both feet, and what came next. Scott, you did go back to soccer, to coaching at various levels. You've remained attached to the game since then. What led you to say, hey, I'm not giving up, at least on this coaching part of soccer?
Oh, after the hospital, I mean, like I said, Rob, that I coached for four more years, but I ended up at the college level. I ended up running into the brick wall depression, which is no surprise. And in the book, that's the first thing I had to do when I was writing, be totally open and honest so people could get inside of my head, inside of my emotions on this. So I did, but I also realized that my coaching was becoming less than, my recruiting was becoming less than. We ended up falling out of the national rankings. I ended up resigning because that's what I should have done for the program. And from there, I mean, I ended up getting into a point where I decided to break myself down in order to build myself back up. I had to go through something extremely difficult in order to, I guess, rediscover myself. So that's a different fork in the road, again, that I ended up taking myself down this time. I was under control this time, and that's what I was going to do.
You mentioned depression being a wall. Another wall came from outside of you, people's perceptions of you as somebody who wanted to coach this active game with a disability. I think you overheard somebody after a job interview saying something like, why'd you bring a guy with no hands in to coach, you know, to audition as a soccer coach? The things you saw from potential employers, from players and others, mm-hmm. How did that affect you?
Mm-hmm. I lost some of my belief in society because I had never, you know, again, I went from a white guy coaching the athletics that was successful to now being labeled as disabled. And I found out what that's been like. And it's interesting, Rob, that I've never been in my mind on how I view someone as being discriminatory against me or not. I've never found discrimination from a female. It's always come from males. And I'm not a psychologist to get into studying that, but it is intriguing. I think it has a lot to do with male mortality and the fear that what happened to me could happen to them. And I don't think males are capable or are less capable than females of being able to cope with something like that. See, because going back, when I first found out I lost my hands and such, I distanced myself. I didn't want to deal with it, so I get it.
One interesting tell that you come back to repeatedly in the book is, what do people do when they go to shake your hand and they see your hands aren't what they were expecting to see?
Mm-hmm. It's most interesting, Rob, when someone shakes my hand, because it's an automatic thing to not look at the hand. You just meet hands. And if they happen to notice when they're shaking my hand, oftentimes, and again, it's always been males, pull back, not knowing, and I get it. You know, all of a sudden you're it's not a physical hand, it's not skin, it's rubber, the glove that I wear over these. And I've come across that sometimes where they've even, I sense a reaction that they have something over me, that they think less of me and therefore my team. But that ends up being a positive for me because I use that in my preparation and thoughts as we go into that match. Because teams, players reflect how their coaches are. And therefore, they just gave me some free information. I'm going to use that information. And most of the time, we ended up beating teams like that. It is interesting.
One of my favorite portions of the book, Scott, is you're coaching for a club team. And the staff there looks at you and assigns you the C team, right? Well, these are the kids. We're glad we're making money from their parents. They're not going to go anywhere. How did you rise to that challenge?
Oh, well, there was a 20-year gap between me leaving coaching at the college level. I had an opportunity to become the head coach at Gonzaga. And I ended up going, first of all, in a very different direction. I ended up becoming a parent of five kids, two from Romania, three from Ethiopia. I came back when my youngest was old enough to be able to handle it. And that's what I ran into, another sense of position of discrimination. They didn't look, I don't know if they looked at my resume, they had to, but yet, no, you're not going to coach A team, not the B team. Here's, you know, 12-year-olds, you get the C team. Yeah, like you said, Rob, bring in those checks. But that, to me, spurred me, because it's strange how life can be. At this exact same time, I was coming around and returning to who I was. So therefore, working with these kids, they were just lacking confidence. They could play. They were just lacking confidence. So we ended up going on the same journey together. And that's what the second half of the book is all about. And I think that's what a lot of people are glomming onto and calling this a positive story in negative times. It's working with those 12-year-olds and how we both, or all of us, went down that same path for saying to heck with you to the people that thought that they couldn't do something and thought that I couldn't do something.
I'm going to detour a little as a lifelong or a longtime soccer parent watching from the sidelines. I love the way you approach coaching with your players. You talk about giving them the skills and the tools they need to make decisions on the field and know the flow of the game and go where they be. Whereas I've seen coaching that's you be in the spot that fits my scheme, and if you don't, you're in trouble. Why do you, and that seems, your way seems a more fun and a better way to develop people. Tell us a little bit about that philosophy.
I don't know why people have gotten, you know, I grew up with football, basketball, baseball as well. And it's all, that's very structured. But the coach, Klaus Kroner, who took me under his wing again when I was 16, I learned about a lot about the freedom of the game. And I studied Johan Cruyff and what the Dutch were doing, and Pep Guardiola with what he did with Barcelona, and then with Manchester City. It's the game itself, Rob, is so free-flowing. For example, I bring a boombox. We play music at our training sessions, not for the players, but for me to try to get them into that flow of the music, because we play jazz, blues, rock, you know, reggae, Motown, even some disco. So there's something free-flowing about it. And I've always had a mantra that has been, my mission is not to teach you, but to put you in a position to learn. It's totally different, but once they get it, once they accept freedom, it's rock solid, and they become better players, and therefore they become a better team. Just because of something so simple, that's the way I look at it. It's simple. This game is free flowing. Why not let the players free flow, you know, flow freely? As long as they have the basic concepts, then they take it where they want to.
And Scott, as we wrap up, what are you hoping people take away from this memoir now that it's out in the world?
I hope they find it thought-provoking. I hope it gets people to talk about the disability community. Heck, we're coming out during the World Cup. Just to stir some conversation. We could all use a positive story. And if it's picked up that way, I'm totally happy with that.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Scott Martin, award-winning soccer coach, educator, and advocate for the disability community. We've been talking about his new memoir. It's called Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. Just heard Scott Martin's story and how he maintained his love for soccer even after the disability that ended his playing career and disrupted his coaching career. And he and a lot of other soccer enthusiasts have a lot to pay attention to these days with the World Cup going on around North America for the next month. I was planning to watch some of the games this time around. So far, I've watched a lot more than I thought I would going in. How about you? Are you watching the World Cup? We want to hear from you. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call and leave us a message at 888-642-0232. You pulling for a particular team or teams? Have you been to a watch party for the U.S. or another squad? If you're raising young soccer players, are they all in on the big tournament? We want to hear your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or leave us a voicemail at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.